Now I'm going to read something which is a little longer than anything that I have read tonight, and which I probably should therefore finish up with. I forgot to ask Lois Shelton how long this reading should last, but I think it's hard for people to listen to awfully long readings. I know sometimes it happens that, stimulated by a very large audience, people sort of go on all night. And I don't know, maybe some people like it, but I think it's really hard to take in that many poems at a go. So I think I will close after this poem that I'm going to read. However, after that, for a short while, because I know that there's also this reception, so it probably shouldn't get too late, but after that, if, you know, there's something that somebody really wished I had read and they want me to, I mean, I could still do that. The audience could leave, and those who want me to read two or three poems more, I could do that. Don't please feel politely obliged to ask me to do it, because I've said that, though. That's, even as I say it, I feel embarrassed by suggesting it, because it might put people on the spot. So don't feel like that, you know. I mean, after all, enough is enough, right? So, this poem, I just want to tell you about its publication. This poem has been published in a little book. I'm advertising the little book because it is a fundraising effort for a movement press in Cambridge called the Holy Street Press. And I'm going to leave at the Poetry Centre a little card with the particulars of what it's called and how much it costs and stuff like that. And all the money from this book, which was collectively produced, will go to the press, which does very useful work in the Boston area. We have also the New England Free Press in Boston, which many of you may know of, because for one thing, it was the press which first produced that book, which has now been reissued by a big publisher, Doubleday, I think it is, or Simon & Schuster, the one called Our Bodies, Ourselves. It was produced by a women's collective, and I mean, it was written by a women's collective and printed by the New England Free Press. The Holy Street Press is in no way in competition with the New England Free Press. They work together, they borrow each other's equipment, and they help each other out. Holy Street is a bunch of very young printers who are living on subsistence, sometimes don't eat very well, and as I say, they do very useful work. They also printed, and I'll leave that a notice about that at the Poetry Centre. They reproduced a very beautiful poster, one of a number that I brought back from Hanoi. These were silkscreen posters, and they reproduced it by the offset system, and that can also be obtained. It's a poster which says, protect the culture, the literature, the arts and crafts, and it's kind of blue and green, mostly blue and green design, and just really a lovely poster. It costs $2. So I'm going to leave the information at the Poetry Center, and naturally I wouldn't be advertising anything that was not a fundraising effort for a good cause, but that's what these are. The poem is called Conversation in Moscow, and it came out of a trip to Russia 2 years ago, which was not at all a sort of, not like my trip to Hanoi, a kind of political trip. This was just a literary jaunt and a kind of wonderful, unexpected vacation. But this one, well, there were a number of moving things that happened there, like visiting Yasnaya Polyana on Christmas Day of, it'll be 3 years this Christmas. That Yasnaya Polyana was the home of Tolstoy, you know, and occurs in so many of his books. And that was a very marvelous thing, seeing the little doctor's office of Chekhov, a man whom, if I could choose, who I could meet in some other world, would certainly be one of my very first choices. And to see his doctor's office and his various things and his funny inkwell, which a patient once gave him, quite ugly, but it was her most cherished possession, you know, and she couldn't pay him, so she gave him this incredible, huge brass inkwell, and he cherished it because this poor woman had given it him. Things like that were very moving. But I guess the conversation out of which this poem came was, for me, the most Russian, the most moving, the most sort of connected with all my love of Russian literature, and with my feelings about poetry, of any of the things that occurred for me during that trip. It presented a challenge in the writing because it was a conversation that involved several people and an interpreter. And the interpreter was not speaking for herself, but only as an interpreter, and yet she was a very important person, an important presence, without whom, of course, the conversation couldn't have taken place at all. And her intelligence and sensibility really informed the whole occasion. So how to get a silent participant into this, a virtually silent participant, even though everything was coming through her voice. How to get her into the poem was a big challenge. I don't know if I have successfully met the challenge. Also, just its dramatic quality, insofar as there were different voices, and I wanted to differentiate them as far as possible. And then I'm not at all sure that I have met. I can do it a little bit when I read it aloud, because I can change my voice pitch. But at any rate, it was a poem that was very stimulating to me, one which suggests to me a kind of poem that I would like to attempt more of. So far, I haven't. Red wine from the Black Sea. Glasses filled and refilled. Georgian shish kebab has been eaten. Plates pushed back. Voices of other diners surround us. Sometimes the five of us speak at once. So much is lost. We are all in our 40s. It is perhaps 10 at night. The woman who is our interpreter knows. She knows poignantly. Now is the night she must speak for us. People look round to see who's come in, all members of the tribe of the word. Chairs are pushed back. Swing door lets out moments of kitchen clatter. She knows she must be, each of us, turn by turn, and each at once. I see their eyes. The fat poet I barely know, but surely love, who pours the wine quietly, his eyes kind, small, and sorrowful. Blue, blue eyes in a tanned face, the veriest azure eyes I've looked to ever. The poet's trusted friend, historian, fresh from the re-examined lives of the nihilists. Will you have ice cream? The waiters returning and leaving again. Pale eyes of the biologist, pale face, white beard, though not old. He's okay, a good guy. But the others know things he doesn't know. He has an aura of limits. I'm looking from one to the other, trying to read language in gesture, grasping what Russian words I know, turning to her who so often looks either acutely anxious or deeply amused, my sister the medium, interpretress, oracle, to give me what these brothers are saying. For there's a spirit has touched us, pulled us suddenly close. Frown lines and laugh lines leave her face. She is looking upward through smoke to the high ceiling and through it, searching each cell, the biologist says, has in it the whole body's potential. And I think of the module of detail giving to InScape its signature, the great web of analogy. But it seems he implies some kind of determinism. I've been saying, I don't see enough communism here. No struggling towards a classless society. Communism to him is only the best we can do with the historic, the social shell in which the creature lives unregenerate. The historian faults him, but I lose that. People come by, greetings exchanged. Red wine from the Black Sea. She searches and finds the eloquent, accurate words of translation. The poet now, out of his stillness, is talking. Poems, he says. Poems are of two kinds. Those with mystery, those without mystery. And are poems without mystery poems at all? Well, yes, one cannot say a poem well made, effective, but unmysterious, has no value. But for myself, I prefer the mysterious. And Dostoevsky, why is it he who's so often clearly reactionary, pessimistic, all for personal redemption and against common action, anti-revolutionary? Why is it he's the 19th century writer I see is most read, most loved in the Soviet Union? Whereas Turgenev, for instance, whose work surely, I think of the Sportsman's Sketches especially. Ah, but Dostoevsky, historian and poet, both are speaking. Who reached as he did into the hot and strange, the cold and shadowy, the intricate depths of life? We read him. We read him because in him we know our own darknesses and illuminations, tortures and ecstasies, our human reality. Tea in glasses, thick black coffee, vodka. To serve the people, I venture, is often thought of wrongly, narrowly, merely as mutual encouragement. But to serve the people in truth, one must do, I think, what Pasternak said one must do, excel oneself in order to be oneself. To serve the people. The poet again holds us in his hands. We are listening shells to whom a heartbeat speaks. To serve the people, one must write for the ideal reader, only for the ideal reader. And who or what is that ideal reader? God. One must imagine. One must deeply imagine that great attention. Only so, in lonely dialogue, can one reach the people. After our musing silences have traveled away, each on its own road, and returned again to this night, this place of meeting, island of our eternity in the bustle and clatter of passing time, now the biologist, pale, skeptical, yet a friend, I see he's at bottom innocent, as only the trained skeptic can be, whose imagination is weak as fine hair, is telling, when I've asked if anyone reads Kropotkin, that Lenin said, after he talked for hours with Kropotkin, "What a charming old man," and shook his head and added, "But he understands nothing, nothing." But later, Lenin sent a train, a special train, back and forth to the place where he, the old man, lay dying, only to ask each day after him. He smiles. He is pale and gentle. To me, it seems, I say, going slowly, waiting for her. She's ready. To me, it seems, perhaps, Kropotkin understood half of what we need to know, and Lenin perhaps knew half, and true revolution must put these two halves together. A flash of sapphire. I hear the historian's words and understand them and wonder. My woman friend repeats in English, how young, how pure. I'm abashed, though he is speaking without mockery, almost tenderly. I, young, pure? Why, I'm 2 years older than our friend here, the poet. And what have I spoken of but doubts, of perplexity? Human doubts. Human longing, he utters the words solemnly, human longing for ineffable justice and mercy. In these lies purity and the worth of men's lives, new as a birch bud in spring. His mind has touched, moved into and out of, as if into sea-carved hollows, bristling with hidden spines, venomous tentacles. The life of Nechayev, killer, shaman. He has known the sacrament of the absolute. And then he says, in the end, we must follow Christ. Is he joking? I turn to my woman friend again, confused. No, no, the historian says, understanding my question. I am not joking. I'm speaking of spirit, not dogma, but spirit, the way. Not the corrupt church, bejeweled priests with dirty beards, prostrating themselves before the atrocious czars. Its indispensable beggars encrusting the entrances of every shrine, kissing with pus the infinite insensibility of relics. Not this, but the frail trust we have when our hearts flutter and we look each to each and our eyes hold the way. And the poet. It's midnight. The room is half empty. Soon we must part. The poet, his presence ursine and kind, shifting his weight in a chair too small for him, quietly says, and shyly, the poet never must lose despair. Then our eyes indeed meet and hold. All of us know, smiling in common knowledge, even the palest spirit among us, burdened as he is with weight of abstractions. All of us know he means we mustn't, any of us, lose touch with the source, pretend it's not there, cover over the mineshaft of passion despair somberly tolls its bell from the depths of, and wildest joy sings out of too, flashing the scales of its laughing, improbable music. Grief and delight entwined in the dark down there.